And welcome back into the Bama Beat Podcast, brought to you by Zaxby's and Wickles. Brett, we'll just go ahead and dive right back in.
Are we going to talk about Georgia now?
No. Georgia's...
That's next week.
Georgia's irrelevant to me now. What they do makes no difference to me.
I've already got my research ready. So if that game goes the way I hope it does, or I think it will, both, let's be real.
Yeah. Do you think it's...
I'm going to be Georgia's AD by the end of that podcast next week, I'm telling you.
Who should Alabama pull for now in that game?
I don't think it matters.
It doesn't matter for their... But
it depends on where you want to go.
Yeah.
Also depends on the upcoming playoff rankings, because if Bama is still ahead of Auburn and still ahead of Florida in the upcoming rankings, then you would assume that's going to hold when none of those teams play a game on Saturday. Then you would want to pull for Georgia if you want to go to the Sugar Bowl in New Orleans, because if Georgia wins that game, we assume both Georgia and LSU are going to be in the playoff. Sugar Bowl gets first pick of SEC teams. After that, Bama's the highest-rated team in the college football playoffs selection committee rankings, and then that would most likely lead them to New Orleans in the Sugar Bowl. So if you want to go to the Sugar Bowl, you're probably rooting for Georgia. Again, all of this is assuming that Bama's both over Florida and Auburn in the upcoming playoff rankings. Again, we're recording this Monday morning. We don't have those at our disposal yet. If you're not particularly keen on going to New Orleans, one, what's wrong with you? It's the best food city on the planet.
Agreed. Now, there are probably a lot of people that are just like, I don't really care where Alabama is.
But exactly. Yeah. That's probably where it's at. Most people don't really care. It's their first year out of the playoff. It's a quote-unquote meaningless bowl game. So I don't think they really care for the most part. But again, my disdain of Georgia is pretty well established on this show. So I'm assuming that Georgia loses the SEC championship game. I get to rail on Kirby Smart for 5 minutes in next week's episode. Georgia goes to the Sugar Bowl, which leaves some combination of Florida and Alabama, assuming both are ahead of Auburn in the upcoming selection committee.
Both should be.
I think they will be. We'll see. That leaves them up for grabs for both the Orange and the Cotton Bowl, depending on how high both are. If both are high enough to be in that at-large realm for both of those games, and it seems more likely than not that the Orange Bowl would prefer to have the Gators just to sell tickets, right?
Yes.
So if Bama is high enough in the rankings, then that could slide Bama to the Cotton Bowl, where they would face most likely the winner of the AAC championship game, which will most likely be Memphis. And this Memphis offense against this Alabama defense, especially if they take some personnel hits, which we'll get to later on, would be fireworks. Fireworks.
This is not setting up well.
That'd be interesting. But the worst they can do, if they don't make those New Year's Six bowls, it seems really unlikely that the first bowl after that, which is the Citrus Bowl, would pass up on Alabama.
Right.
So the Orlando is the fail-safe here. Orlando is the fallback. So those of you with young children might want to invest in going to the Citrus Bowl so you can take your kids to Disney World or whatever.
Right. Okay. I think we covered that pretty well.
We're already on the bowl game, so should we discuss the potential for attrition there?
Interesting.
Or do we need to finish the Iron Bowl discussion first?
I wanted to talk about this defense a little bit.
Okay. You know what's funny to me, and I need your help on this one, because when I think about this defense and what it should have been and what it ultimately has become, I think a lot about fan bases of teams going into a rebuilding year. Like, say it's a middle-of-the-pack G5 program. They had a good coach. He coached them up for a couple good years. They maybe made a run at a conference title game, and then he goes and gets a P5 job. You replace that guy with someone who doesn't go well. You got to fire him, and you're starting from the ground up on your rebuild. I think fans are generally pretty good at being honest about their team in the preseason. They're pretty good at saying, hey, man, it'd be real cool if we could go 5-7 this year. Because if we go 5-7, that means we upset somebody in conference, or we did a couple of interesting things over the course of a rebuilding year. That'd be cool. That'd be fun. Let's see if we can get everything to line up for us and go 5-7. That'd be a fun year for a rebuild. Cool. There's a difference between saying it in the preseason and living it.
Right.
And I think there's often a disconnect there when the same fan base who's like, hey, let's see if we can go 5-7. That'd be fun, right? When it's November and the team is 4-6 or 3-5, and they're saying, this team is terrible. This coaching staff isn't working out. Fire everybody. Restart. The recruiting is off. Herp da derp da der.
You're talking about Ole Miss here?
I could be talking about a lot of programs.
Sounds like Ole Miss. you could say
I wasn't thinking about them in particular, although I guess you could make an argument there. And I wonder, and this is where I need your help, because full disclosure, I think most people know this. I got this job 5 days before, or I started this job 5 days before the Duke game. I wasn't here for the preseason.
Right.
I didn't get the full context of what fans thought this defense was going to be after Joshua McMillan went down, after Dylan Moses went down, after the major draft attrition they took after last season. So, but I remember thinking that especially when Dylan Moses went down, I remember thinking that's going to cost him a game. You could argue it cost him two.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember thinking this defense, there is talent, albeit young and inexperienced talent. There is talent, and there is reason to believe that that talent will be significant enough to make them solid, but probably not the top five unit that Alabama is more often than not on defense. That was my expectation. Was that the general expectation of the fan base in the preseason?
Yeah, I would say so.
Then that's what this defense has been. We've been over this over and over again. This is not a top five unit, but it's not 50th in the nation either.
I think the big problem is when Dylan Moses went down, especially, everybody said the one guy you couldn't lose was Tua Tagovailoa. The next guy you couldn't lose was Dylan Moses, and they lost Dylan Moses, so everybody was like, this is real bad for Alabama's defense. Everybody acknowledged that, and everybody said, here's what were the two thoughts from a lot of people who were predicting Alabama's season, whether it be fans, whether it be analysts, whether it be guys like us. It was Alabama's offense should be good enough to outscore opponents when they have to against a young defense who's, you know, suffering a lot of turnover, like you've kind of mentioned. The expectation was that by the end of the season, the experience or the lack of experience, things like that would no longer be an issue, and Alabama's defense would be back to playing a high caliber of football. And I think that's been the most frustrating part for Bama fans, and I can fully understand that.
That's a fair criticism.
Right. There hasn't been development on that side of the football. In fact, you could argue they've gotten worse. Now, here's the thing. That is fair to say, but they've continued to add injuries on top of Dylan Moses and Joshua McMillan on that side of the football. That's what I don't think people understand.
Is the LeBryan Ray injury just going totally unnoticed for you?
I didn't say he was going to have a Quinnen Williams type of rise, but I did say
nobody has that.
Right. I didn't expect him to be a top five pick in the draft that type of year, but I did say that I feel like he could be the guy to step up that, you know, had been in a rotational role. He was well known to people because he was a five-star. Quinnen Williams was a four-star, not as highly regarded coming out of high school. So it wouldn't have been as out of nowhere as Quinnen Williams was, but I said that I felt like he was the guy that right now people weren't talking about as being the type of player who could rise and become a first-round pick. I really felt that way. We'll never know. We might see next year. But as of right now, we don't know what would have happened this season with LeBryan Ray. I do know one thing. He was expected to pick up a lot of the slack from the interior pass rush from the departure of Quinnen Williams.
Welp.
And Alabama all year, what did they struggle with? Interior pass rush. Now, Christian Barmore has been phenomenal in adding that in certain situations. But especially to start the season, that was not necessarily a thing. I just feel like when you talk about guys that continue to get banged up, DJ Dale didn't play in this game against Auburn. He's your starting nose tackle.
Another thing that goes totally under the radar.
Right. I mean, so you're losing two of your starting defensive linemen, both linebackers behind them. You know, compared to what everybody thought was going to be the starters heading into this year. And one of them had just occurred. So, I don't know. The expectation that they were supposed to be world beaters by the end of the season, with what continued to transpire over the course of the season, I feel like is a little unfair. Now, granted, this isn't – we're not making excuses for people. But I will say this. I've seen Pete Golding get heavily criticized, and some of it is warranted. I'm not saying that he's been perfect or he's been even fantastic or great. But I just don't know with him. We can't know. Who's to say, with all the things that Alabama has dealt with guys who they were expecting to come back, Mac Wilson, Deontay Thompson, heading into last season, they did not expect Quinnen Williams to have the type of rise that he did as far as being an NFL prospect. Mm-hmm. So they were expecting to have him for a couple years. Granted, they had plenty of time to kind of learn that over the course of last season, so it wasn't as big of a hit, but they were fully right. expecting Deontay Thompson and Mac Wilson to come back. And then you talk about losing the one guy you couldn't lose on defense, and then you talk about losing several other guys over the course of the season. Does Kirby Smart do that much better of a job than Pete Golding, or does Jeremy Pruitt? I do think they do better, but here's the thing. That does not make necessarily Pete Golding a bad defense coordinator. He was just a bad defense coordinator for what he was going to have to deal with this particular season. Yep. Jeremy Pruitt was more equipped to handle because of his experience on the big stage, dealing with talent and players and development. Pete Golding was still learning in that area. I think in any other season, if Pete Golding has Jonathan Allen and Deron Payne and all those guys playing as well, Rashawn Evans, I mean, Minka Fitzpatrick, the list goes on and on. I don't think any Alabama fan's complaining right now.
Yeah.
Whatsoever. And he's still the same guy. And I think that Nick Saban understands that. I can't definitively say that he would be that guy. I don't know. Nick Saban knows more about where Pete Golding is at as far as being a defensive play caller than any of us. So if you
Wait. Are you saying Nick Saban knows more about Pete Golding than Twitter does?
Surprising, I know.
That cannot be possible.
Right. It's not like they sit in the same office every day, have all these meetings. And
that's definitely not the case.
Here's the other thing. A lot of Alabama's problems, lack of discipline, that falls as much on Nick Saban's shoulders as it does Pete Golding. Nick Saban has a huge hand in the defense, a huge hand. And Alabama fans just choose to completely ignore that, give him all the passes in the world, and sit here and criticize Pete Golding when it's like, I would say they're at most, they're pretty darn close to equal parts in this. The guy calling the plays defensively on Saturdays is Pete Golding. But the guy who's to say he's calling a terrible game? Hard to know when you've made a stop and your defense jumps off sides and hands him a first down.
It's hard to know. Like Nick Saban said it in the game, after the game, he said he found himself asking several times in the game, why are they spitting this run? Like, we called a defense. We thought with the defense we were in, we should be plugging up this run. So why are they spitting it?
Right.
That
exactly.
tells you that against LSU, and I said this, and I think you agreed, I thought Joe Brady was a step ahead of Pete Golding the entire game.
I completely agree with that.
The entire game. Joe Brady took Pete Golding to school on that November night in Tuscaloosa. I think we both agree with that. I don't think that was the case here. And Nick Saban kind of hinted at it.
Agreed.
He isn't one to go out of his way to throw players under the bus very often, but when he says something like that, you have to look at it and say, Nick Saban is of the belief that the players weren't executing the defense as they were called.
Yes, and look, if you're saying – you point to specific examples to me – what Pete Golding should have been doing differently from a play calling standpoint, and we can put that on Pete Golding because that's his job on game day. When you're complaining about the lack of discipline and those types of things, and you're putting that all on Pete Golding, that's a mistake because Nick Saban is just as involved in that process as Pete Golding is. So you cannot blame one without blaming the other. And everybody says, oh, the common denominator or the different denominator is Pete Golding compared to, you know, Jeremy Pruitt and Kirby Smart.
How many new defensive coaches are there this year?
Oh, man. And here's the other thing. Everybody's saying Pete Golding needs to be fired. So let me get this straight. Once again, you want new coordinators next year. More coaching turnover. I mean, I think Alabama's in a great position to keep its defense coordinator, to keep its offense coordinator. I think Steve Sarkisian has done a fantastic job. Has he been perfect? No. But he has been fantastic, in my opinion. You keep both of those guys, and you have what? Continuity. And then that's been the complaint every offseason in the last few. Alabama has no continuity with its coaching staff. Fire everybody. They're the same people on Twitter. It is very frustrating to me because you can't have it both ways.
No.
I think Pete Golding getting guys back, having the guys that got the experience that they did this year, will end up making a it will pay dividends next season, in my opinion. We'll find out more about what Pete Golding is about. Am I saying that I think he's going to set the world on fire as a defensive coordinator starting next year? No.
And this part is important. Y'all listen to this.
I'm saying I don't know. And you don't know. The people on Twitter don't know. You can't tell me that he's a terrible defense coordinator any more so than I can tell you he's a great defense coordinator. Give it time.
There is no room for sample size on Twitter.
Right.
Or in society at large, but that's a different topic for a different day.
Right.
There's no room for sample size.
And, I mean, you can say we don't know how much the injuries and all that stuff has made an impact. We simply don't. Give the guy another year, and if he continues to struggle with guys healthy and things like that, then you can start to say, okay, now we know this guy's not good. And I'm right there on board with you. Mm-hmm. And I'll be the first person to say, okay, time to hit the hay. Tosh Lapoy left because he didn't want to be demoted. That's what that, in my opinion, came down to. How many guys accept a demotion and stay on the same coaching staff?
Only that dude at Washington.
Yeah. Good. And that's a good example, actually.
And Ensminger.
Yeah.
But those are both very, very strange circumstances.
Yes. And Ensminger.
There's a reason I can name both of them off the top of my head. Because
yes.
It's so incredibly rare.
Yes. And when he got... He was not nearly ready to be the defense coordinator at Alabama, which is why Pete Golding, who had experience calling plays on Saturdays, ended up kind of transitioning into that role late last season. Yet again, a ton of injuries. And maybe that's just something that Alabama defense coordinators or coordinators in general at Alabama are going to have to get used to, because they seem to get key guys hurt every season recently. And if that's the case, you got to find the guy that can overcome that, and that might not be Pete Golding. I'm just saying... People say I hate definitive language. Like, oh, I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, Kirby Smart would have this defense top five. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, Tua Tagovailoa does not make that throw and cause Alabama pick six there. You don't know that. I can't sit there and tell you that he wouldn't, but or that he would. But at the same time, I always like to say, I think this is what I believe. I don't think Tua probably would have made that throw. Okay, but to say he wouldn't have, and you know that for a fact, I'm sitting here pointing to a Clemson clip saying, you know, he's willing to make a boneheaded decision every once in a while. We could talk about the Tennessee as well. Just there and say that he wouldn't have made some kind of other costly mistake in that game is very naive. I'm getting off on a tangent. I told you this was going to happen.
I agree with pretty much everything you've said here. I think it's – I made the joke about sample size, and to a certain extent, college football is always going to be a small sample size sport because we have a 12-game regular season. But there is some room for nuance and context here, and I don't think we have that on Pete Golding yet. I very much agree with you in that regard. It all circles back to the original launching point for this conversation. My kind of corollary about it's easy to set expectations in the preseason, but it's harder to actually watch it happen. Do you think that's more or less happened with this defense this year? Do you think this defense has set, or do you think this defense has more or less jived with what was a fair preseason expectation for them after the injury, and people are having trouble squaring what their preseason expectation is with what it actually looks like when it happens in front of them? Do you think that's right?
Yes.
And I have some numbers to support that conclusion. Let's see. Alabama in yards per play allowed, 19th in the nation. Alabama in yards per carry allowed, 43rd in the nation. Alabama in third down defense, 31st in the nation. Alabama in yards per attempt allowed, tied for 8th in the nation. Alabama in red zone touchdown percentage allowed, 40. Where'd you go? Oh, really? You're going to do this to me? It was better than 50. I know that. It was 47th in the nation. Alabama in turnovers forced. Turnovers forced. Tied for 4th in the nation. Alabama in SP plus defensively, which we've referenced before. Opponent adjusted, tempo adjusted measure of efficiency. 7th in the nation. Alabama in opponent punts per play. Does that make sense? Do I need to explain that? Like, how often you force teams to punt?
To the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, how often your opponent's plays are punts, so more or less how often you force them to punt relative to how often they're on the field, tied for 36th in the nation. This is not Oklahoma's defense.
Right.
Even this year, when Oklahoma's defense is like significantly better than it has been in the past, it's not Oklahoma's current defense, which is a lot better than it has been, and it's not Oklahoma's defense in the past when it's been truly like burn your eyes out bad. It's not that. It's not the top five unit that we generally get out of Alabama for the most part. So I think this defense has more or less done what we thought it would. And people are having a hard time coming to grips with that.
Well, and the other thing, too.
And everything you said about P. Golding and the injuries and the inexperience and everything else, all of that is the reason for that. Currently, if they have the same issues, either to the same degree or worse next year, depending on the roster, then we might need to have a conversation about P. Golding then. But I think right now, to have that conversation about P. Golding is a little premature.
We also, I don't have specific numbers to back this up, but I want to bounce this off of you and get your thoughts. Alabama's defense really started taking a fall from being a nationally ranked top-tier defense last season, right?
There are numbers to support that.
Now, Tua Tagovailoa became the starting quarterback last season. He continued to be the starting quarterback this season. Look at LSU's defense, who is also always known as being elite. LSU goes from a ball-controlled, run-heavy offense to this Joe Burrow slinging the ball around just like Tua Tagovailoa. And what happened to their supposedly elite defense over the years? It's now one of the worst defenses in the SEC. Or I wouldn't say worst defenses, but it's in the same. It's worse than Alabama's statistically, right? Do you think that there's not any correlation there? I'm not saying that it's all connected.
I think the correlation is circumstantial.
And what? Elaborate.
It can be done to have both a good offense and a good defense. Clemson had it last year.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, Alabama's had it in the past. It can be done. It's just, and watch out. It's really hard to do.
Yes.
It's really hard to have a top five offense and a top five defense. It's really, really hard to do.
Now,
because you got to have elite talent on both sides of the football. You got to have elite coaching on both sides of the football. And you got to have the roster turnover fall just right for you. Last year, Clemson would not have had both an elite offense and an elite defense if its entire defensive line didn't skip the draft and come back to Clemson for a senior season. That's the thing in this sport when you only have 4 years of eligibility unless you're Riley Norris. And the roster turns over so quickly, especially when you're at this elite level and you're recruiting elite talent that is almost, well, I was about to say almost always, and that's not true. When it's often good enough to go to the NFL after 3 years, your roster turns over at such a high rate, it's really, really difficult to have a very good offense or an elite offense and an elite defense at the same time. It's very difficult. It's not impossible. Playing offense this way doesn't prevent you from playing defense at the level that Alabama fans and Clemson fans and others would like. It's just very difficult to do in the sport of college football. And if you want teams to be consistent in what they do year over year for a decade at a time, go watch the NFL.
Yes.
Go.
Yes.
Because that is where consistency is possible. It amazes me that there is this expectation of consistency at this level where your roster turns over at least 25% every year, and it could be more than that in the transfer portal era, right? Your roster turns over this frequently, and I don't mean to start the whole, like, quote-unquote amateur debate, but they are, in the most literal sense possible, or at least in the most technical sense possible, amateur athletes.
Yes.
They are not paid a living wage to be athletes.
Yes.
They have other obligations as students, and again, if you want to make the jokes,
and
you can.
And youth is involved, too. They're younger.
That's
right,
and they're young. Like
NFL players are at the very least are 20, 21, 22.
I think in college football, we shouldn't expect consistency. We should be impressed by it.
I
imagine there are a lot of people listening to this podcast that have what we like to call normal jobs, right? Like in this industry, we're working all over the place. We don't go to an office with the same people every single day. We're on the road working weird hours. So when I say a normal job, an accountant or a banker or something like that, you have a traditional office job, your hours are pretty regular. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there working quote-unquote normal jobs listening to this podcast, and you're living that office life, right? And you're getting paid a lot more than we are. When you all have interns in your office, do you expect consistency or you strive for consistency? when you have a paid salaried employee that does the job well every single time, on time, et cetera, you're not impressed by that. You expect that because you pay that person to do that and you pay them a good bit of money. When an intern does that, when a 21-year-old still working through his college degree, his or her college degree, does that, you're impressed by it. And you probably treat that person differently because they've earned a certain level of respect. We should probably do the same thing when it comes to college football players and NFL players. The expectation for consistency at the college level kind of undermines everything that it is in terms of roster turnover, age, amateurism, quote unquote, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, one way that I've heard it put, and I think that you can apply this really to anything in life, turn your expectations into appreciations. When you do that, you're a lot more happier.
You're a happier human being.
Yes. It's things that you expect can disappoint you. Things that you appreciate cannot.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of off topic, but at the same time, I think that it somewhat applies here. Now, going back to the high, you know, scoring offense and its correlation to a poor defense, I would need to see the numbers, but Clemson's high-powered offense, I don't think they were scoring as quickly as Alabama's offense did, or, you know, kind of continues to do at times when Tua Tagovailoa was the quarterback, or LSU's offense having Joe Burrow as the quarterback. I'm more so compared, and I would need to crunch the numbers. I have nothing that I can say this. There's a direct correlation here. This is just speculative on my part, but I would compare it to the way that Chip Kelly had Oregon back in the day. They were super high-powered. They were looking to score as quickly as possible, and they always had a garbage defense. Clemson, I would have to go back and see, but from what I remember of watching them last season with that top-tier defense, they were an offense that pretty much could score at will, but they would do it with dry. They weren't looking to hit big plays. They weren't doing quick slants that would go 80 yards several times a game,
yeah,
you know, like Alabama seemed to do. So I would have to actually crunch the numbers there, but that's just kind of where I'm at with things, is why I think some of this stuff. And here's the thing: you try to put the why behind something, which is what I always try to do. Why is this happening? Why is Alabama's defense struggling? And when you actually start to share your why, the reason that you think is happening, it's just simply an excuse. I'm just trying to explain why I think Alabama's defense has been so poor this season, because at a lot of times it has been poor. And is it, you can't just simply say, oh, it's Pete Golden, get him out, get someone else in. It's not, I mean, actually try to identify what the actual problem is. Now, I'm going to go ahead and tell you what I've decided, because we've already gone over an hour. Listener, by this point, you've already come to realize that this is what has happened. We're going to cut this up into two. So I'm going to release one and then the other, because I thought we got good points on both sides, because
okay,
I do want to continue this discussion, or not the defense, but get back into what we were wanting to talk about.
Okay.
So I'll kick it back to you and let you kind of take over from here.
There's so much. What are we doing here?
Bowl game.
Okay. All
right. Alabama lost. They're now going.
Okay, so
bowl.
I'm going to be completely honest with you. I'm a little distracted because we're recording this at 9:38 a.m., and there is a report out there that Lane Kiffin's going to be the next head coach at Arkansas.
Oh, boy.
I don't know that it's verified. So I'm assuming by the time people are listening to this podcast, at least several hours later, it's possible that all this has been rooted out. And if it's fake news, then you can laugh. But if it's real, then like what?
Dude, I got to be honest. I've said this, and
you
I continue
have.
To say this.
You've been Lane Kiffin's agent these last few weeks, man.
I think Auburn missed the mark here. I really do. If you want to talk about, and granted, with Gus Malzahn getting this win on Saturday, you can say that he has been a pretty big thorn in Alabama's side. He's 3-4 against Nick Saban. He's, you know, I mean, this is really the, not a, I'm trying to think about this. They could prevented Alabama from any sort of postseason aspirations in 2013, and then they did it, of course, again. They thought they did it 2017. They didn't. Alabama still won the national championship. And then, of course, they did it this season, and looks like they're going to keep them out of the playoffs.
Yeah.
So you can argue Gus Malzahn from that perspective has been a thorn in Alabama's side, but I just feel like Lane Kiffin was the perfect makeup from everything that he does well and likes to do and stir the pot, where he would have been – that would have been – you know, zigging when everybody else is zagging.
Yeah.
If Auburn would have done that. And I kind of like the hire from Arkansas if that ends up happening.
Okay, yeah. So it could be fake news. It could be not. We'll see. So we have, I want to talk about the offensive game plan for a minute.
Okay.
I thought it was interesting how, and you mentioned it earlier, they were obviously attacking the perimeter.
Absolutely.
To force Marlon Davison and Derrick Brown to cover ground or run to, in theory, wear them out. And I'm not sure it worked because their pass rush was excellent.
Now, at certain points in the game, Derrick Brown was cramping up second quarter.
Yes.
It was working until Auburn started having some longer drives. They were able to get to halftime, and then Alabama's defense was allowing Auburn's offense to have long drives. I just think they right there in the middle of the game where you really could have shut this defense down and taken their legs out from under them, they gave them massive breaks between halftime and then, of course, sustained drives by Auburn due to Alabama's inability to get out the field on third down.
So I wanted to bring it up because not only was it intelligent and a good idea, shouts to Stark, but it also made me think that it might be something this team does going forward with more frequency, especially for the upcoming bowl game, which kind of ties into a bigger conversation. Because what this game plan does on the offensive side, we know what it does on the defensive side. It forces the opposing defensive line to run and cover ground and pursue screens from the inside of the field or kind of fight blocks going to the outside and force them to cover ground to chase a running back and do all those things. But what it does is it allows you to attack all portions of the field without having to rely on your wide receivers to attack the outside portion of the field. You can throw screens to your running back. You can pull two linemen and run to the outside that way. It allows you to attack all portions of the field without having to rely on your wide receivers to do it on the outside. It also kind of puts an emphasis on your three interior linemen because they're doing a lot of pulling with the perimeter runs, right? As lead blockers, or at least that's the way Alabama does it. You could do it with outside zone, but Alabama did a lot with pulling linemen. And I wonder if that behooves this team next year, if not for the bowl game, because we've obviously seen Alabama hasn't been subjected to it because they've been in the playoff, but we've seen how insignificant bowl games or non-playoff bowl games, how highly rated draft picks have skipped those games and saved their bodies and gone straight into the draft process. There are a lot of players on this team that fit that mold. And I think it's unfair to speculate on personal decisions they have to make in the coming days. So I'm not gonna project or predict which guys are going to, but guys that fit the mold of guys that are highly rated draft picks that probably don't need this bowl game to prove anything. Henry Ruggs III, Jerry Jeudy, Devontae Smith, Najee Harris, Jedrick Wills for sure, Xavier McKinney, Terrell Lewis.
Alex Leatherwood.
You could probably put Alex Leatherwood in there.
Xavier McKinney.
I did mention him, but okay, I thought I did. Maybe Trayvon Diggs fits that mold. There are a lot of guys that there is a precedent for some of them to miss the bowl game.
And the other thing that's going to add to their decision, you just less than a month ago watched what happened to Tua Tagovailoa. And I think that watching what a lot of people had for a short period of time thought was potentially a career-ending injury and the hit that his draft stock's taken as a result of it, we don't know definitively that it's going to, but we assume. At this point,
I think it's going to be interesting how the same people that were clamoring for Tua to have not been on the field against Mississippi State are also going to clamor for these guys to play in the bowl game instead of skipping it.
Great point.
Tua, another point I'm stealing from Cecil. You should don't have me on the podcast ever. Just talk to Cecil all the time.
No, you're right.
Tua was playing for a championship at that point.
Yep.
These guys in the bowl game, they won't be.
Yep. But
again, I'm not telling them how to make their decisions. I'm not telling people how to feel about their decisions. But I do think it's interesting that if a lot of those guys take the bowl game and sit it out, particularly the wide receivers, the game plan you saw against Auburn is probably Alabama's best option. Because if you take those wide receivers away, you still have Waddle, but you still have unproven commodities, talented commodities, and John Metchie and Slade Bolden and Terrell Shavers and some of those guys. But you still have unproven commodities at wide receiver other than Jalen Waddle. So you got to attack all portions of the field to make whoever you play in the bowl game stay honest. And one way to do that would be perimeter running with, even if Najee Harris sits out of the bowl game, you still got Brian Robinson Jr., you still got Keelan Robinson and his hashtag juice. So this game plan that we saw, it could behoove Alabama in the future, when they definitely don't have these wide receivers in 2020, or at least don't have most of them at the very least. Maybe one of them comes back. We'll see. I just thought that that game plan was applicable in more ways than just tiring out Auburn. I think there's a case to be made that it could fit Alabama's personnel both in that Auburn game and then in the future, in the bowl game or in 2020.
I think you make an excellent point, and I'll follow it up with this question. Do you think Alabama fans really care if Alabama wins their bowl game?
I think it's up to the individual person. I think it's easy
as
to
far as the majority.
I think it's not easy. I think it's easy to not care about the bowl game right now.
Right, but when it actually pushes,
but when
to
it,
shove,
but when it comes up, when people see the crimson and white and the numbers on the helmets and everything else take the field, I think they're suddenly going to care about winning the football game.
Okay, and that's very fair.
And that's what fandom should be, right? Like, you should want your team to win the football
game. The reason that I asked that question is this. If you're like, you know, I wanted to win, but if they don't, like, it's not the end of the world. I'm not really, you know, it's not the national championship. It's not the playoff.
Not invested in it as you would have been the Mississippi State
exactly.
game.
Would, if that's how you feel, would you not want guys that are planning to leave early for the NFL to go ahead and sit out?
You would.
Because you want to see the guys behind them, the potential replacements. You get a live in-game look extended. We've gotten to see a lot more about Mac Jones. We know a lot more about him because Tua Tagovailoa got hurt.
And not only that, but you also want those guys to make those decisions pretty early so that guys like Slade Bolden and Terrell Shavers and John Metchie and some of the others are getting starting reps in practice throughout this entire bowl game practice.
Exactly.
Setup.
And that gives them a huge leg up heading into spring practice. If you get to go an entire month being the starter, being labeled as the starter, practicing as such, starting to learn what it takes to be the starter, and then turning around and getting live in-game experience against a what's going to be a very good opponent, regardless of who they end up playing. Even if it's a team like Memphis, there will be some criticism on opponent, but Memphis is a good team, and especially gives guys defensively. We've already seen plenty of young faces on that side of the football as it is, but the guys that you're going to be working with next season, it gives them a great chance to kind of prove themselves in that sort of situation and continue to get, you know, live in-game reps. So it could certainly be beneficial. At least that's my opinion. If anybody chooses to sit out at this point, not only would I not be surprised, not only would I sit there and say that makes a lot of sense, I wouldn't blame them, and I think it could ultimately end up working out for both parties if they do,
yeah,
depending on the person.
That's a good point. I hadn't considered it that way. And I'm sure we'll get into the actual particulars of the individuals that do choose to sit out the bowl game, if any of them do. We'll get into the particulars of that later on. But I do think that's an interesting wrinkle to consider in this next couple of weeks when Bama eventually figures out what bowl game they're going to go to, and they kind of figure out who's going to play and who's not going to play. Just because not only the thing you mentioned with the practice, but also because it kind of gives you a window into an offense that we've been looking at it this way for a while now. An offense that's going to change a pretty good bit because Tua, we assume, is not going to be here. We assume they're going to lose at least two of those wide receivers, if not all three. We assume Najee Harris is going to go to the NFL after this. So you've got a lot of personnel changes. If they were to choose to sit out the bowl game, that would be kind of a way to a window into what you got. Now, I would caution people to not read too much into bowl game performances either way, because how many times have we done this where we read too much into a bowl game and then we spend an entire offseason hyping somebody up or hyping a team up, and then they get to the next season and they fall flat on their face? The current example, hey, Texas fans,
yeah,
we're back. Now you've got the starting quarterback, the same dude that said that, and the AD out here saying, hey, man, 7-5 is super cool. Hook 'em.
Yeah.
We're 7-5. Hook 'em. What?
Yeah.
Get out of my face with that. They did the same thing with Sam Darnold. After that awesome Rose Bowl with USC and Penn State, we did the same thing with Sam Darnold. And then this dude's got his own podcast that he's doing weekly. And now, and then he falls flat, and now he's a mono meme. Now that's what he is. He's a meme. That thing of him pointing into the camera and nodding his head, and everybody's putting hilarious text on it. The best one of that. Were you a King of the Hill fan?
Watched it a little bit. Didn't watch it.
The big King of the Hill fans will remember this. But my favorite one was when the text on the screen said, "That's my purse. I don't know you." That was amazing.
I feel like if you're a King of the Hill fan,
you're going to get
totally
that reference
that.
For sure.
And I'm pretty bummed out that I haven't.
Look it up on YouTube.
I have to.
I'll send you the link.
You need to.
Man, it's so good. Anyway.
I can tell that's probably going to be fantastic.
But yeah, we do this all the time with bowl game performances, and it drives me crazy, man. Like, don't read so much into these bowl game performances. It's not it's useful. For Alabama's perspective, because again, if you get in a situation where these guys are given starter reps for basically a month and in a bowl game, it's useful, but it's not grounds for definite analysis one way or the other, I don't think. And that's where people can get led astray, horns down.
Yeah, and to be quite honest, not saying Alabama's going to play bad in that bowl game, but if they do, do not be surprised. I'm just going off of what we've seen with Alabama, whether it be against Utah in, what was it, 2008?
Yes.
Whether it be Oklahoma in 2014? No, 2013, maybe? Derrick Henry. Yeah, 2013.
Yeah.
That was his freshman season. What we saw was a team that didn't want to be there. Now, we're not making excuses. It's not anything like that. It's just simply saying, based off of history, Alabama has not performed well in these games that didn't have much, national implications. So we'll just have to say, do not be surprised if they struggle.
The placement of the bowl game is going to be interesting to me because, as I kind of outlined earlier, a lot of this goes down to where they are in the selection committee rankings. If the committee has them ahead of Florida, that might get Alabama preferential treatment to a certain extent. If they get ahead of Auburn, they definitely are given preferential treatment to a certain extent there. So where do you think Bama's going to end up in the playoff committee rankings?
Ooh, I think they're going to probably be...
They were 9 in the AP poll. I personally had them 10th.
I would put them in that range, and that would be behind Florida and ahead of Auburn. I don't think... I get Auburn has the head-to-head victory, 3 points... on the road at Auburn. We saw how things shook out. Could have very differently went a different way. I think everybody understands that. So while they had the head-to-head victory, they have 3 losses, and Alabama has 2.
That's the thing. I think I'm interested to see how this committee handles it because every other committee would have said head-to-head is a tiebreaker or the common opponents are a tiebreaker when the resumes are pretty equal. And yes, the whole Alabama quality win thing, we can touch on that if you want to. But their resumes are not equal because Auburn has lost these 3 games. And Bama's only lost 2, one of them to the number 2, apparently, team of the nation, and one of them at number 15, by 3 points. So the resumes aren't necessarily equal. That's how the previous selection committees would have taken this. This committee's different, very different.
They are.
And I don't know that they're going to take it that way. Like, I can't predict this committee, so I don't know what they're going to do.
I think you have an excellent point. And I'll be curious to see. Like I said, I think you're right. I think that 9-10 range is spot on for them, probably behind Florida and ahead of Auburn. That's just where I would predict it. We'll have to see. Also, I've not expected a lot of things to go down the way that they have with this committee, like you said. So if we end up being wrong, I wouldn't also, be overly shocked.
It would make sense for the committee, which places so much on just watching games. It would make sense for the committee to say, we watched this game. We don't think there's much separation between Alabama and Auburn. Auburn won the game, so we're putting Auburn ahead of Alabama.
Which
would jive with how they've acted over the course of the season. I'm not saying that's right or wrong.
Right.
That would jive with what the committee has done for a significant portion of the season.
Yeah, which is, I don't disagree with that at all.
Do you care where they go? In terms of location.
Oh, location, of course. I mean, I don't know what I don't have really a preference.
The options on the table at the moment are more likely to be either Orange Bowl in Miami or Cotton Bowl in Dallas. They could fall all the way down to the Citrus Bowl in Orlando. And if literally everything goes perfectly, they could end up in the Sugar Bowl in New Orleans.
Yeah, which is...
But hey, man, it's not that bad. Like, this...
That's a pretty crazy fall, though, considering, you know, you're talking about 1 week, you go from, you know, a lot of people predicting you're going to be a playoff team, regardless of what happened to your starting quarterback, to Citrus Bowl. Like, you know, you just... But that is the way things...
Hey, man, there are worse places to go than Orlando.
Oh, from a travel standpoint, from a bowl standpoint, I still, this day, I know that players get little perk packages or whatever from the bowls they go to.
Yeah.
One of my best friends, William Ming, actually played at Alabama from 2009...
I remember that name, yeah.
...to 2013 and won several national championships. But he still, if I'm not mistaken, I recall him saying that his best... perk package that he got during his time at Alabama was when they went to the Capital One Bowl in 2010.
Really?
Yeah, he said that was by far the best kind of gifts and stuff that the players got. And that was, you know, one of the few seasons he didn't go and play for a national championship, or, you know, where Alabama didn't.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, it could be beneficial for Alabama in some ways. But at this point, we know we're going to see them play one more game of football, and it'll be very interesting to see how that all ends up going down. With players who are going to be there, who won't be there, you know, who's going to get some reps. Well, I guess just have to see.
But have we touched on everything?
I think we have. We've gone an hour and 20 for us. This is going to be a couple of a couple of 40-minute pods, which are still long. But, hey.
We gave y'all several opportunities to do something about this.
Yeah, and I mean, still...
And maybe this is the breaking point.
I think the fact that I'm divided into 240. Maybe if I'd slept an hour and 20 up there, I got a feeling we'd hear from some people.
Yeah, maybe breaking it into two episodes is going to be like, okay, guys, that's a little excessive. Maybe we found the breaking
point.
There
is so much to talk about from this, and we always end up getting on tangents and getting carried away and turning this into a lot longer than it needs to be. But I also feel like sometimes you got to talk stuff out, and I certainly feel like we've done that today. We appreciate you guys tuning in. This has been a lot of fun. Brett, I'll see you next week. This has been the Bama Beat Podcast, brought to you by Zaxby's and Wickles.